The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Being Mortal is presented by Dr. Marianne Holler and Ms. Teresita Silverberg-Urien. The session is moderated by Megan Knight.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to be showing you a documentary that was produced by PBS and Frontline called Being Mortal. We started this program last year through the Hospice Foundation of America, who wrote a grant all across the country to get these end-of-life discussions and education started, and over the past year, it's been screened thousands of times, literally to tens of thousands of people. In New Jersey, where we are, we've had six screenings, and we couple it with clinical education in addition to community outreach. So we give two credits of CME in end-of-life care, and we also do CEUs for nursing. So it's a one-hour documentary. After the documentary, we will be doing a panel discussion with Dr. Marianne Holler, who's on my left, as well as Tacy Silverberg-Urien, who's a hospice nurse, also with VNA Health Group. So we hope you enjoy, and we'll follow with the panel.
Frontline.
All the stuff you learned about in medical school is just a tiny little bit of what it means to be good at our jobs.
Based on his best-selling book, Being Mortal.
So many people I see, their death comes as a complete surprise.
Dr. Atul Gawande takes us inside conversations with doctors and patients about dying.
The disease will be wrong.
Oftentimes, what we say as physicians is not what the patient hears.
A personal journey.
My dad cried, my mom cried. I cried. He did not want to end up on a ventilator. And he said, let me die.
The struggle between hope.
What did we forego by pursuing treatment after treatment after treatment, which made her sicker and sicker and sicker?
And making peace with the end.
The last couple of weeks, I've been surrounded by family and friends. Some of the best days of my life, I must say.
Tonight on Frontline, Being Mortal.
Is made possible by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Major support for Frontline is provided by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is available at macfound.org. Additional support is provided by the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Wincote Foundation, and by the Frontline Journalism Fund, with major support from John and Joanne Hagler, and additional support from Chris and Lisa Koenig. Support for Being Mortal is provided by the John and Juana Harmon Foundation.
Grateful.
Tonight on Frontline.
All the stuff you learned about in medical school is just a tiny little bit of what it means to be good at our jobs.
Based on his best-selling book, Being Mortal.
So many people I see, their death comes as a complete surprise.
Dr. Atul Gawande takes us inside conversations with doctors and patients about dying.
The disease will be growing.
Oftentimes, what we say as physicians is not what the patient hears.
A personal journey.
My dad cried, my mom cried, I cried. He did not want to end up on a ventilator, and he said, let me die.
The struggle between hope.
What did we forego by pursuing treatment after treatment after treatment, which made her sicker and sicker and sicker?
And making peace with the end.
The last couple of weeks, I've been surrounded by family and friends. Some of the best days in my life, I must say.
Tonight on Frontline, Being Mortal.
Is made possible by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Major support for Frontline is provided by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information is available at macfound.org. Additional support is provided by the Park Foundation, dedicated to heightening public awareness of critical issues. The Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. The Wincote Foundation, and by the Frontline Journalism Fund, with major support from John and Joanne Hagler, and additional support from Chris and Lisa Koenig. Support for Being Mortal is provided by the John and Juana Harmon Foundation.
Surgeon for more than a decade now. In medicine, your first fear as a doctor is that you're supposed to be able to fix a problem, and our anxieties include wanting to seem competent, and to us, competent means I can fix this. In fact, there's often a kind of implicit promise, I'm gonna be able to fix this. I'm gonna certainly give you the best shot you can have. Nobody could have given you a better shot. And when things aren't working, part of your anxiety is, was there some implicit promise, I'm gonna be able to fix this. Was young, she was enthusiastic, she wants to tackle this. You don't wanna be the downer. So you're looking, you're grasping for a straw that says, well, there's something here that's gonna be beneficial. Stage 4 lung cancer, we know it's not curable. But suppose she's the one that somehow gets cured. Maybe she's the one. And so therefore, we should do all these things to her. Having any kind of discussion that would begin to say, look, you probably only have a few months to live. What do we do to make the best of that time without giving up on the options that you have? That was a conversation I wasn't ready to have. I don't think any of us were. Hey there.
Dr. Gawande, how are you?
How are you?
Come on in.
Take me back to when she's pregnant, she's doing great.
Yep.
39 weeks, your due date is coming, and
the collapsed lung would not allow for a C-section. It was too dangerous to be opening her up with all that fluid buildup. So Sarah had Vivian basically pushing with one lung. It was so difficult. But she had the baby. You want to be part of that 15% that survives one of the 5 years. You want to be that part of that group so badly. Yeah. And you say to yourself, why not us? You know, it wasn't about how can we have good days to the end. We didn't focus on that enough. We're trying to stabilize the situation and try to become spend a little bit of time as a family. But it was an impossible situation, impossible summer. I mean, it's just excruciating.
When I came on the scene was when she got diagnosed with a second cancer. You know, in my mind, what I was thinking was I wouldn't offer this surgery because the lung cancer is gonna take her life. And yet I didn't feel I could say that to you all. I think we started talking about the experimental therapy that you all would like, were hoping to get on for a trial with the lung cancer. And I remember saying something I sort of regret, which was, you know, maybe that experimental therapy will work for the thyroid cancer too. I said that, and I know it was complete.
Well, you had joined us in our sunny disposition, hoping for the best.
I knew it was not gonna. I mean, in other words, the reason I regret it is because I knew it was a complete lie. I just was wanting something positive to say.
I did not know it was an outright lie. You could lose your license for that.
I know. But I don't think I was terribly equipped for having that conversation. And maybe you all weren't.
I don't think we were. I've thought often about what did that cost us? What did we miss out on? What did we forego by consistently pursuing treatment after treatment after treatment, which made her sicker and sicker and sicker?
The very last week of her life, she had brain radiation. She was planned for the experimental therapy the following Monday. You woke up and she wasn't doing so well on a Friday. What happened then?
So she woke up and was gasping for air. And I tried to crank the oxygen up. I said, let's max this thing out. Maybe we can get a bigger oxygen machine. We were so close to getting to the next potential fix. And she said, I can't do this. I can't do it at home. I'm too scared. I'm gasping for air, and I can't do this. We should have started earlier with the effort to have quality time together. The chemo had made her so weak that she couldn't hold Vivian. It was exhausting. And that was not a good outcome for the final months. Yeah. It's not where we wanted to be.
In the last 3 months of her life, almost nothing we'd done, the radiation, the chemotherapy, had likely done anything except make her worse. It may have shortened her life.
What was interesting to me was how uncomfortable I was and how unable I was to deal well with her circumstances.
It felt like a revelation in that here was a case which I could unpack enough to understand, why do we always go off the rails? It made me want to explore what other doctors were doing in these extremely difficult circumstances. What I hoped was that maybe I might learn something that I should be doing differently. I work at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston. They're connected together across one street. It's here that my colleagues let me observe their experiences with patients facing the end of life, the struggles and the difficult choices. One was Lakshmi Nayak. She's a specialist in cancer of the brain. And she has to have these end-of-life discussions with almost all of her patients.
You picked a pretty tough field, right? So how many of your patients will you cure or help them have a better life?
It's almost always fatal. We have, you know, each of us has an odd patient who survived for 10 years or 15 years. But that's less than 5% of all of the patients that suffer from the most common malignant brain tumor. So yes, I don't get to tell people I'm going to cure you.
One of Dr. Nayak's most challenging cases at the time was a man named Bill Brooks. He was 46 years old.
Bill has brain cancer. That basically, in his case, has led to raised pressure in his head. He feels really well. Bill's sister had also died of a brain tumor, and that was what he was worried of the most.
How did they look?
Look delicious.
They always look delicious. Everything is good for you. You eat anything. You know, we're so lucky. We have each other. We have great families. We have great friends. We have great jobs. We live in a beautiful home. And we've been lucky. And then, you know, all of a sudden, it's like our world was turned upside down.
It's a battle. You know, some people say don't listen to the numbers, and I always say, well, that gives me something to shoot for. You know, if they tell you 5 years, let's go for 6, 7, or 10.
That's good. You're all right. So Bill's story from the very beginning has been challenging because when I first saw him, I thought he had 5 to 10 years. That changed. His symptoms started getting more aggressive.
The headaches.
The headaches, the not being able to lie down. I actually called Mary. I said, we don't have much time. We probably have a few days to a month. And I told her she should take time off work.
He started having pressure in his head, and we... Paper towels, this is good. So, Dr. Nyack gets very,
She takes it very personally.
She takes it very personally when she has to give us bad news. So she basically just told us to get ready. And so, you know, of course you have your pity party. And then you kind of like, don't give up hope.
So after the phone call, Dr. Nyack ordered a series of spinal taps to relieve the pressure in Bill's brain. And it worked. The pressure came down, he felt better, and they had new hope. But the disease was still progressing.
You started having some pressure. Can I check a few things?
Yeah, absolutely.
Follow with your eyes. Eyes wide open. What I was looking into your eyes was not the way your pupils reacted, but to see what the pressure might be. And I'm worried that the disease will be growing.
I think that it's important for us, even though it would be easy to sort of skip over this today.
Yeah.
That we should talk about if things are not going as we hope, to just talk about worst case scenarios a little bit.
And then best case scenario too.
Okay. So, best case, obviously, you know, we'll just continue what we're doing if you think that's the right path. And
what made you jump in to say best case as well as worst case?
I think that I scared them the first time.
You're thinking back to when you talked about it
before. Yeah.
And you're worried that you'd lose their confidence if you only talked about the bad side.
Yeah, and especially because he had been responding to treatment, it just gives them some hope, as long as you're not giving them unrealistic expectations out of treatment.
He's worth a shot.
What's a third option?
There's no third option.
There has to be a third option.
But you've been on.
We do things together. We often are finishing each other's sentences. If Dr. Nyack had said, let's talk about worst case scenarios, then I would have said, and we'll talk about best case scenarios.
Have you thought at all, as far as worst case scenarios go, if you would want hospice at home or hospice at a facility?
Do it at home.
When we talked about hospice, I was reading Mary's body language that was sort of saying to me, don't go there. But given all the things that were going wrong, I felt like we had to do that.
Have you thought about anything after the MRI?
My thought, and Mary's heard me say it a lot, is I want to see the next one to kind of see if it's showing anything or not before I start to get worried or get too hopeful. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
It was amazing to see how my colleagues had these conversations. And it was teaching me what I might do better for my own patients. It turned out it also taught me how to do better for my dad. He got some bad news back home in Ohio.
I remember I took notes in my journal around that time. Do you remember when Dad first started to get pain in his neck?
He had pain in his shoulder. Mm-hmm. And he thought that either playing too much tennis or just muscle. So when the result came, we were in a shock.
He got an MRI. And as a surgeon, he knew the results were not good. He emailed the images. I opened them up, and it's a huge mass, and it's concerning. He called me up, and as we're piecing it together over the phone, we're kind of realizing this is right in the middle of the spinal cord. So the puzzle is, how do you get this out? We're two surgeons looking at a mass. It's like two carpenters looking at a house, you know? You're not saying, oh, yeah, we can't fix this. But, you know, at the end of that conversation, I'm thinking this could be a life-threatening problem.
It was hard for us as a family to talk about this, and that's despite the three of us being doctors. In fact, talking with anyone near the end of life about their decisions is so difficult. There are actually physicians who specialize in the process.
Okay,
called palliative care physicians, people like Kathy Silvaggi, who works at the Dana-Farber. Her technique is as much about listening as it is about talking.
What would be on your checklist for what I should make sure I do when I'm doing it next time?
First of all, I think it's important that you ask what their understanding is of their disease. I think that is first and foremost, because oftentimes what we say as physicians is not what the patient hears. And if there are things that you want to do, let's think about what they are and can we get them accomplished?
You know, people have priorities besides just living longer.
Yes.
You got to ask what those priorities are.
Yes.
You got to tune the treatment to those priorities.
Exactly. And if we don't ask and if we don't have these discussions, we don't know.
Paul, I'm Dr. Silvaggi.
Dr. Silvaggi works with doctors throughout the hospital to help with their hardest patient conversations.
So, how are you feeling?
I'm a little better than I was when I first came in.
Eamon Alfeeki was one of those doctors. He's an oncologist who, like me, grapples with reaching good decisions with his patients about dying. He'd been caring for a patient named Norma Babineau for 2 years.
He said that during that time, he had tried to broach how dire her prognosis was, but he had not been successful.
Let me start by giving you both an overview of where we're at now, because the cancer has developed a more aggressive course to it, right? It's a more resistant type, but it just keeps marching along. This is where the tough discussions come up. The disease, we knew, has been acting up. Right now in this state, what treatment would hurt you more than help you? That's just a fact. And you would not get the benefit of it.
Is there a timeline, or?
We could be talking about 3 to 4 months. We can be longer. It can certainly be shorter if the pace picks up.
This miracle's not gonna happen in between.
It's a question you had to ask, and I don't want you to dwell on that. If I were going to bet on somebody doing better, I would be betting on you to do better than that timeline.
Our goal is, for whatever time is left, is to make it the best quality that we can.
You know what's hard?
But I need to take the baby to Redmond.
To where?
To Walt Disney.
To do Walt Disney.
Yeah. Yeah, we're going to take off for Christmas. We gotta find the right medicine to get me better so I can take my trips.
So the really hard part, I find,
in these situations is, you know, it'll come to this point. When do you help them understand that? What's going through your mind, though? What does it feel like to you?
That I wish I could do better.
It still feels like a little bit of a failure for us, doesn't it?
It's very much a failure.
Yeah.
Right, and it's hard.
But even though you knew from the beginning, you weren't going to be able to, you weren't curing this problem.
Right. It's just a fight mentality that perhaps goes back to training in med school and just the way we are wired, and we're not trained for that other mode.
That's where we have to take our cues, because I think
palliative care doctors like Kathy Salvaggi are different. They're teaching us there might be a better way in these circumstances.
No, and I think it's hard to hear sometimes the timeline, but I think it's also important to have a sense, because if there are things that you want to say or do or people that you want to see, it helps you define that time a little better.
I think she knew that she was getting sicker and weaker. One of the goals was to try to get her home with hospice services, but the medications and the things that we're requiring, it's just not going to happen.
Forget Disney World. We're not even knowing whether we can leave the hospital.
Exactly.
So we didn't do that before last Monday. Feels really late in the game, you know?
It does feel a little bit late in the game. We're all sort of taught that in order to make a difference in our patients' lives, we have to be doing something. We have to be operating, we have to be giving them a medication, we have to be radiating, we have to be giving chemotherapy. In some ways, I think the medicine is the easy part. It's all of this other stuff that's much harder to deal with.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
I wanted to talk with you about, I know the other day, Norma, we talked about where to go from here. You may need more and more IV or intravenous medications to control your symptoms, and I'm worried that we're not going to be able to do that at home. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's coming close.
When you say coming close, that we're coming near the end.
Yeah.
I worry about the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what we'll do is we'll keep you here, and we'll take care of you here. Okay. Yeah. All right. All right, we'll see you a little later, okay?
Okay.
Okay. Why don't I clean this out?
Kathy Salvaggi had helped Norma understand that she was dying. Still, Norma had little time to say her goodbyes. She died 10 days later.
These are really important conversations that should not be waiting the last week of someone's life. Between patients, families, doctors, other healthcare providers involved in the care of that patient.
There's no natural moment to have these conversations, except when a crisis comes. And that's too late. So I began trying to start earlier, talking with my patients, and even my dad. I remember my parents visiting. My dad and my mom and I had sat in my living room, and I had the conversation, which was, what are the fears that you have? What are the goals that you have? And, you know, he cried, my mom cried, and I cried. He wanted to be able to be social. He did not want a situation where if you're quadriplegic, you could end up on a ventilator. You know, he said, let me die if that should happen. I hadn't known he felt that way. This was an incredibly important moment. These priorities became our guidepost for the next few years. And they came from who he was as a person, who he'd always been. My dad came from a little farming village in the middle of India, you know, thatched mud huts, no running water, a village of about 5,000 people. His father had 13 children. His mother died from malaria when he was about 10. That was when he decided he wanted to be a doctor.
He went to medical school in India. Afterwards, he was offered a job in a hospital in New York City, training to be a surgeon. He met my mom and married her, and they moved to Athens, Ohio, to set up their medical practices and raise a family. There, he was part of the community, and that became especially important to him after the cancer. As the tumor slowly progressed, we followed his priorities, and they led us and him to choose an aggressive operation and then radiation, but eventually paralysis set in, and then our options became chemotherapy.
So the oncologist lays out 8 or 9 different options, and we're swimming in all of it.
Temozolomide, vincristine.
Then started talking about how, you know, you really should think about taking the chemotherapy. Who knows? You could be playing tennis by the end of the summer. I mean, that was crazy. It made me very mad because it was
completely not right. Yeah.
You know, this guy's potentially within weeks of being paralyzed. The oncologist was being totally human and was talking to my dad the way that I have been talking to my patients for 10 years. It was holding out a hope that was not a realistic hope in order to get him to take the chemotherapy. I then pushed. We were still in the back of our mind thinking, you know, was there any way to get 10 years out of this anymore? She basically was saying no. And we needed to know that.
Medicine often offers a deal. We will sacrifice your time now for the sake of possible time later. But my father was realizing that that time later was running out.
He began really thinking hard about what he would be able to do and what he wanted to do in order to have as good a life as he could with what time he had.
I guess the lesson is you can't always count on the doctor to lead the way. Sometimes the patient has to do it. When I first learned of Jeff Shields, he had already gone through 3 years of treatment for a rare form of lymphoma. Chemotherapy hadn't worked. He hadn't given up hope, but he was also recognizing that his odds were diminishing, even as his doctors were offering him more treatment options.
Well, my experience has been that oncologists, at least my doctors, are basically optimistic. And they're always looking for a way to push the disease into remission than they are in talking about the longer term picture of mortality. Oh. I spent time talking to Jeannie, my wife, thinking about, at least for me, I want to make a decision. I don't want to linger.
We've had conversations about all aspects of what the end of his life might look like. And most of all, he says, I want to be at the farm. And, you know, hopefully I'm in a position to make sure that happens. We have an appointment that I hope will result in them saying that the disease is lessened, but they might say, no, it's not under control. And then we're going to start having a conversation about mortality. And because I don't think there are so many more choices for Jeff in terms of treatment.
My man. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Jeff.
Rob.
Hey, how we doing?
Good.
Okay,
thanks
good.
For coming over.
My pleasure.
Any results on the biopsy?
Yes. The preliminary results do look like graft versus host disease. And that's not necessarily so surprising. We expected that.
I first met Mr. Shields about 2 years ago. At that point, he had a bone marrow transplant. And unfortunately, about a year after the transplant, he showed signs that his disease was coming back. In addition to that, he has a complication of transplant where the donor's cells are actually attacking his body. And unfortunately, it's wearing him down.
It almost goes without saying, but we may have to make a new game plan a week from now.
To feel really crummy or spend the last 3 or 4 weeks of my life in the hospital is not very appealing to me.
I bet not.
And so when we get to that point, I'll rely on you to make sure we have that conversation.
Right. And it's a group discussion for
it sure
all
is.
Of us. Yeah. All right. We'll see you guys.
It's always a hard thing, right? How do you know if they're coming towards the end versus changing the therapy again?
Well, I don't think we ever know.
Right.
But with Jeff, he was a very thoughtful fellow, and thoughtful in the sense that he had considered what might happen down the road. And he made it very clear to me that if we thought some therapy might be helpful, might prolong his life with reasonable quality of life, he was happy to go for it. He also made it very clear that if we thought that things were going to go badly, or things looked like they weren't going to work, he didn't want to pursue therapy just for the sake of pursuing therapy.
It seems to me there's such a difference in these last few weeks. And we know the lymphoma is growing and sort of rampant. What I'm worried about is, could we be coming to a place where it is actually killing you and we don't have the opportunity to really talk with the children and the...
You mean where I am in what I consider in hospice, in other words, yeah. End stage.
Yeah.
And we don't have, I'm going to live for 4 weeks, and we are thinking, oh, maybe there are 3 months.
Yeah.
I think we should ask that at our next visit.
All right. Here. Go into your Benadryl stupor.
Unfortunately, your bilirubin is up, but the other liver function tests are a little down. I can't put a particularly good spin on that. I don't know how negative a spin to put on that. But I can't put a good spin on that.
I wanted to clarify something.
Yeah.
I said, I don't want to go back in the hospital. I want to die at home.
Yeah.
And that's really my goal.
Yeah.
And so I want you as my doctor, my good friend, to know that.
Yeah.
The hospice people will know it.
Yes.
Jeannie knows it. That's my desire.
Right.
It's impressive for a patient and a family to be so clear about their priorities, like Jeff Shields was. Accepting that life can be shorter than we want is very difficult. It's easy for all of us, patients and doctors, to fall back on looking for what more we can do, regardless of what we might be sacrificing along the way. And that's especially the case with younger patients. And that is where a doctor needs to be skilled, I think.
It's always a challenge how to say it, that this is not working and I have nothing more. I try to deliver the bad news in pieces over a period of time. I feel a lot of times they don't absorb all of the information, and that's why you have to keep repeating it. And
you saw that with Bill Brooks.
Yeah. So the MRI, there's a little change
unfortunately. There's a small area, a new spot. It's not super large, but it's there.
This is the beginning of the end. I think it's progressing to an extent that we may not be able to do anything to control it. He's one of those few people in whom, you know, if there's something that you could try, it's worth trying, rather than just waiting.
What do you think about the AbbVie? I just saw it on the news yesterday. They just got FDA approval for one of their brain tumor medications.
That drug, we actually have a trial with that drug. I'll look into it. I'll look to see what the status of that is and see if it makes sense for you to get it. It's not going to be on a clinical trial for you. If we do it, we'd have to do it as a compassionate use. And I wouldn't want to give you something if it would potentially make things worse. So I'll definitely look into that.
Bill brought up this particular drug, but it is experimental.
Are you at all worried that he would just have toxicity from the drug without benefit?
Yes and no. At this point, I knew that he wasn't going to live for too long without anything. So whether he had, at least he felt that he could try.
Bill was only able to get one dose of the experimental drug because he was getting sicker. The spinal taps were beginning to stop working.
Okay. Push, push.
The pressure in his head continued to build, and the effects were becoming undeniable. That was when he began to prepare.
I'm really declining quickly. I need a lot more help even doing basic, you know, basic walking and things like that. Well, they're over there, too.
I can get them.
I just don't have the strength in my left side, so if I get leaning one way, I can't catch myself.
Can I flip them?
Yeah.
Let's see if I can get them off.
Took me 15 years to collect this. The more valuable and more collectible things are, you know, from back years ago.
Is it just this pile? You have more than that.
If I die tomorrow, she's not going to know how to dispose of this properly to get the most bang for her buck.
Let me just move all these canvas ones.
Well, those are going to be the good ones.
These are the good ones?
The canvas ones, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that one's a good one.
Oh, I like that one, the ones underneath, too. This one's
just I'm just overwhelmed with everything. The mental roller coaster has been the hardest thing to deal with. So it's like, okay, am I dying? Am I not? Can I function? Can I not? You know, and then they're trying to tell you, stay positive, keep hoping, keep fighting. And I'm like, I've been doing that for 2.5 years. I'm at the end of my ropes as far as that goes. Can't take any more bad news. I'd rather go into the meeting and have her just pull a gun out and shoot me than have to listen to her try to be nice while she's giving me bad news. Like I said, I'm a positive person, but I'm at the end of my ropes with it. I fought as best I can.
Accepting death comes with incredibly complex emotions. Bill's hopes for more years had turned to weeks, and the question became when to let go of treatments if they're not helping, to accept what Dr. Nayak and Sandra had been conveying about considering hospice.
I think we need to talk about what's been going on for the last few days. The fact that you didn't respond to the spinal taps, I wouldn't want to put you through any more spinal taps. There is going to be a time when we're not going to be able to deal with the pressure. With the steroids. We will be able to help with pain, and in making you comfortable. I'm worried that your disease is progressing quickly. We've talked about, you know, hospice before. And I think this is the time where we need to discuss a bit more about it.
Well, Mary and I have talked many times. My thought again is I'm not afraid to die, but I'm afraid of all the suffering that goes beforehand. So we're trying to find out, you know, when that is going to come to pass, just so we can say goodbye to each other.
We should just pause for a minute. So much information.
Impressive just being able to be silent for a while. Were you deliberately trying to be silent and let it happen?
Yeah. I think it's important to pause at the right time. Sometime. It's a lot of information.
This is here. Good news. Hopefully, your last bad news for the day.
At this point, it's just making sure he's as comfortable as he can be, you know, and that's the most important thing. You know, what's working against him in a way is that he's young and strong. It'll just mean that he'll linger longer. And this is it, yeah. It's basically just let him just go peacefully. You know, unless there's another miracle.
Depends.
Yeah, it depends on him, so.
Yeah, I'm gonna go check on him. I just wanted to make sure he's okay.
Are you okay? I'm right here, sweetie. I just want you to be comfortable.
Bill died 2 days later.
As this home time began to unfold, I began to realize how difficult it was. Partly because our house was not organized or arranged to comfortably do this. You know, suddenly you have a hospital bed in the middle of your living room.
Then I need you to help me bring my feet up.
Don't know that.
Here, Malcolm, we're going to help Pop-Up take his slippers off. Can you do that?
You want it to be as comfortable and happy a place for him as it can be. And at the same time, it's, you know, it's sort of the elephant in the room.
You know, at that time, that...
All right. Okay. Just lean back.
Okay. Have I talked to you at all about my thoughts on dying? And
yeah.
Is it too hard? Okay. Let me just tell you this. I'm not afraid of dying. I've had a long and wonderful life.
And one of the nice things about being at the farm is that you realize everything dies. There's a cycle of life. The cows die, the trees die, the grass dies, the fish die, and people die.
Aren't you sad that you're going to be missing out on a lot of things?
Well, I will be. And, you know, I had hoped to have another 10 or 15 years. But you don't always get what you want, right? I love you.
I love you too.
See you in a few minutes.
In those last weeks, you know, as his space narrowed and narrowed to that bed, it grew in terms of the people he was drawing in. I hate to cry, sorry. but that's another one of those paradoxes, you know, as your world comes closer and smaller, it becomes bigger and bigger. And he was seeing that.
In the last couple of weeks, I've been surrounded by family and friends, and it's been terrific. You know, some of the best days of my life, I must say. But then there's a downward trend that's more rapid than I had expected. I felt great during that time, and my body was in rapid decline. Since then, my mind has been in rapid decline. I get confused. But I'm still a happy guy.
Jeff Shields' words about his last weeks being his happiest seemed especially profound to me because they were among his last words. He died just hours afterwards.
In medicine, when we're up against unfixable problems, we're often unready to accept that they are unfixable. But I learned that it matters to people how their stories come to a close. The questions that we ask one another, just as human beings, are important. What are your fears and worries for the future? What are your priorities if time becomes short? What are you willing to sacrifice and what are you not willing to sacrifice? My father answered these questions.
He entered hospice 4 months, as it would turn out, before he died. And he was a person mostly during that time. He was not a patient.
You know, my dad Skyped with everybody back to his village in India. He had me and my sister come there and be with him. And he remained in control of the priorities that were most important to him.
I remember sitting in a chair, reading the newspaper, light coming in the window. My mother and my sister were having a conversation. And then we realized he wasn't breathing. We waited to see if there would just be one more breath. And there wasn't.
My dad made his wishes for what his life would be like to the very end very clear to us, including for what should happen even after the very end. He wanted to be cremated. in the traditional Indian way, and he wanted his ashes spread on the Ganges River. We took his ashes, my sister and my mother and I, to the ancient city of Varanasi, one of the oldest cities in the world. We, with a swami and a boatman, taking us out in a dinghy, and it was an amazing thing.
Millions, literally millions of families have brought the ashes of somebody in their family who's died to the Ganges. That connection to people going back that many years makes you feel like you're connected to that many years going forward as well. You're just this speck in time.
I felt he had brought us there and connected himself to all that was important to him. How is dying ever at all acceptable? How is it ever anything except this awful, terrible thing? And the only way it is because we as human beings live for something bigger than ourselves.
PBS.org/frontline for more from Atul Gawande about death and dying.
What are your fears and worries for the future? What are your priorities if time becomes short? What are you willing to sacrifice and what are you not willing to sacrifice?
Join a special conversation with Frontline using the hashtag WhatMattersMost on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, or Instagram. And tell us, if you had only limited time left, what would be most important to you?
So thank you for watching this film with us. Sorry about the technical difficulties again. But after following the four people in the film who are facing terminal cancer, we're all reminded that we're mortal. And as Atul draws on his personal reflection on his father living as a person, not a patient until the end, this awakens his sense of what's important in the end of life, and he's forced to acknowledge his practice as a physician didn't always achieve his patients' desired outcomes. So we're here to talk about, you know, how we can make it better, how we treat the person as a whole, mind, body, and spirit, and not just their disease. So I want to introduce our panel. On my immediate left is Dr. Marian Holler. She's the Chief Medical Officer at VNA Health Group in Homedale, New Jersey. She's also a board-certified hospice and palliative care physician. And to her left is Tacy Silverberg-Yorian. She's an RN, also a certified hospice and palliative care RN, and she's a community liaison and case manager. She also wrote the book, The Last Mile of the Way, which is available on Amazon if anyone's interested in reading about it. The first thing that we want to cover is communication skills. You can see in the film that the clinical treatment of a person only goes so far. And to really, determine what the person's goals are, you know, and what their understanding is of their disease, we need to talk about what their understanding of the disease process is. So, Dr. Holler, if you can explain to the audience, as a palliative care physician, you know, what this ask-tell-ask method is.
I use that phrase. It's actually from the Vital Talks, vitaltalk.org. They train physicians to have difficult conversations regarding prognosis and having these real difficult communications with patients and families at the end of life. So we start, as Kathy Salvucci in the documentary says, if we don't start with the question, what do you understand about what's going on, or what have they told you about your illness, we really can't move the conversation forward. So when you ask that question, it's very interesting what you're told at that point. Because I ask, so, you know, the patient's in ICU, whatever, and I'd say, so what have they told you? And the answers you get are, well, the heart doctor says this, and the lung doctor says this, and it really only takes like maybe 90 seconds to 2 or 3 minutes for them to communicate that to you. And then your opportunity is to tell them what's going on as it relates to their particular health or their family member's health. And then clear up kind of what things mean, because they'll say, oh, the lung doctor says their lungs are getting better and the kidneys are no worse and the heart is strong. So, but what does that mean in somebody that has end-stage congestive heart failure, end-stage COPD, or stage 4 cancer and other comorbid conditions? And then after that, ask them, one, if they have any questions, and two, based on the information we just discussed, what's the goal? Because if we don't ask what the goal and where we're going, we're conditioned, we're trained in medical school that the patient has A, we're supposed to do B. And a tool brings that out in the documentary, like somebody presents you with a problem and we're supposed to react in a certain way or provide a certain response because we want to fix it, we want them to get better, we want to instill hope, we want to give good news. But and hopefully we're training our next generation to deliver bad news and have appropriate conversations at the appropriate time.
Right, and people who are hearing bad news or are under stress and duress actually only retain 20% of what they're hearing, which is, I think, Dr. what Nayak was referring to, that, you know, you have to repeat yourself to make sure that they understand and comprehend what you're telling them. Tacy, I want to talk to you about how when you're in the hospital and you're going in for a hospice referral, how do you prepare to learn, because New Jersey is a very diverse state. We have all cultures and ethnicities. I want to know how you prepare yourself so you know what to expect when you're going into the room, you know, in terms of cultural competency.
Well, I believe that cultural competency really improves healthcare outcomes. So prior to visiting or having that family session in response to a hospice consult, I will review the chart and look at what type of religion, their ethnicity. I will also speak with the social worker, the nurses on the floor to find out a little bit more about the family and about who makes the decisions. It's very important. For instance, working in the Jewish Orthodox community for a while, you know, I learned about the halakhic pathways. I learned that, you know, discontinuing life support or anything to hasten death is really not acceptable. So these are types of things that you do not want to do a cultural faux pas about. And I think in our country, we can have this ethnocentric type of attitude that everybody is the same or everyone should be like me. And so knowing, is this a first generation, second or third generation family here in the United States, have they assimilated? These are all very important things to understand, because a newly immigrant a person coming to this country, you could kind of generalize, but once, you know, they've been here in the country for longer than a second and third generation, they may have assimilated and had these types of conversations already. Also, the other thing is, we kind of inadvertently insult some types of families by not knowing who they are. For instance, walking into a lesbian or gay family and asking the lesbian family, "Where's your husband?" would be a major faux pas. And knowing that, you know, in oftentimes in that particular community, they may have maybe not biological family, but family that they have considered, you know, very good friends, and they consider them family. So you have to be very, very astute to these things. Same with Hispanic families, and not a generalization, but typically there is a spokesperson for that family. It's typically the oldest son or daughter in the family that's going to be speaking for the patient. And I've also found that many of my Hispanic families have a very hard time with this hospice concept of, you know, they want to force feed their loved one. And if we're not doing anything, they feel like, you know, it goes totally against their culture. So we have, in the past, you know, started IVs at their request so that they felt something was being done at the end. You know, working at this hospice residence, sometimes we would have to do that. So these are just, you know, some of the cultural nuances that we should be aware of, because in order for us to have this difficult conversation, we have to gain their trust. And in order to do that is to go in very compassionately, empathetically, and also what's very important is knowing that you have time to spend with this family, because this is not a conversation that can be rushed through.
Thank you, Tacy. And we saw that when the palliative care physician came in to see Nora. I mean, that was their first introduction, and she had a lot of work to do to build that trust. And I think that's very important. I just want to point out to everyone, if you have a question for the panel, we're not going to do open mic, that you can text us a question. The phone number is at the bottom of all of our screens. So I want to just say, Rick had a question for Dr. Holler. You referenced a source and, you know, how to handle end-of-life discussions. And the organization that Dr. Holler had referenced was vitaltalks.org, if anybody wants to jot that down or check it out. Next, we're going to go through a case study of a patient who's 84 years old. She lives with her daughter and grandchildren. She has end-stage heart failure. And all of this whole list of comorbidities. So Dr. Holler is going to review the case study with us, and you can see over the past 12 months all of this patient's hospitalizations. And we want to just point out that this film, you know, follows cancer patients, but, you know, obviously end of life is not just cancer. It's, you know, many, many diseases, particularly in the elderly who have multiple comorbidities. So, Marianne, if you want to go through this.
Right. So, and statistically, I've been tracking my own practice, and only about 26 or 27% of the patients that I see in palliative is about 26 or 27% cancer patients. Mm-hmm. So, the majority are heart, cardiovascular, strokes, COPD, other end stage illnesses. Now, the thing I want to point out, now this obviously is a very, very familiar patient to all of us. Kind of elderly. We know she has multiple comorbid conditions. She's been coming in and out of the hospital. And really what the effort is across the country is to instill primary palliative skills kind of across all specialties. Because what happens is the 9th, 10th, you know, 7th, 8th, whatever, hospitalization, this patient comes to the attention of the palliative care team. And if you don't have that resource in your hospital, then it is you who needs to identify these patients early in the spectrum. And as you go back to her hospitalizations, yes. So you see a continued decline, the slope of the decline, especially in end organ type illnesses, isn't like a nice linear path that you see in other illnesses. So end organ paths, end stage liver, end stage kidney, end stage heart, all those kind of have that varying kind of path, but the slope, when you look at point A to present day, is a continued decline, but they have those ups and downs, exacerbations. And then you kind of can look at the patient and say, I always say, tell me about Christmas. Tell me about Easter. Tell me about New Year's. Some point 6 or 8 months before, are you better, worse, or the same as you are now? And then tell me about the hospitalizations. When you know, get better, get out of the hospital, go to subacute rehab, do you ever get back to where you were when that initial exacerbation happened? And then I'm able to talk to the patients and families to see that the decline has been in a continuous direction. Now, the interesting thing, I heard Diane Meyer, who I don't know if any of you have heard of Diane Meyer. She's pretty much the grandmother of palliative care in this country. And she references 9/11. And if you think about what happened on 9/11 and the planes were hitting the building, when the plane got low enough, what did the majority of those people do? They tried to reach out and connect with their families, the people that were stuck on the top floors of the towers. They connected with their families, even to leave messages on answering machines. However they could, they were attempting to reach out and leave messages. And if we don't have these conversations early enough and that patient ends up in ICU on a ventilator, we've robbed them of that experience of saying goodbye in a meaningful way. Because then the family comes to the bedside and you're like, what do? Do we trach and peg them, or do we, you know, say, terminally extubate the patient? So if we don't have the conversations way upstream, we're robbing them of that basic human instinct of saying goodbye in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. So it's frustrating because the palliative team, we see people 7, 8, 9, 10 hospitalizations into it. They're now cardiorenal, they're, you know, all kinds of comorbid conditions and exacerbations and ventilators and the question of feeding tubes, and everything gets woven into that last 48 hours. Some of you know the support study, which is the kind of most famous study on end-of-life care in this country. And they found that DNR orders are written within the last 48 hours of life. We get to the finish line, we see the finish line coming. We don't warn anybody, but we know it's coming. We hit the wall, and then we're like, crap, we hit the wall. We better talk about this. And we're so afraid even to discuss code status in a meaningful way that the patients and families really aren't prepared.
And that's not goal setting, having a conversation about a DNR when you're 48 hours away from death.
So, you know, because when we have most of you have the pollster, the most form in your state. So when it says, you know, what's your goal? Like, what's the goal of care? And people say, well, I want to live as long as I can. And I say, well, that's great. I want that for you too. But if things don't go how we hope, you become weaker or get more compromised? What types of things are important to you? Do you want to be at home? How do you feel about these multiple hospitalizations? How do you feel about how you're spending your time? Because up to that point, trying to point out to the patient that the disease is controlling how they live their life rather than them taking control of the disease and deciding how they're going to control the disease may be very empowering to patients and families.
Right. And Tacy, well, I have a few questions from the audience, but before we go to those, Tacy, can you just go into some universal of sorts resources for advanced care planning? We use the Five Wishes in New Jersey, but if you want to go through, and that's a great way to start conversations, if you want to go through that.
All right. Well, I know for we've been very successful using the Five Wishes, which is through Dignity. It goes through pretty much, you know, the it goes beyond just the medical interventions, which is why many people choose the Five Wishes. The Pulsed, which is what we use, is a physician's order for life-sustaining treatment. And we're starting to see physicians and nurse practitioners use that more. And I know in the legislature, we're trying to get it so it's across state lines, that mm-hmm. it is going to be universal across state lines.
Right, because some states have a Pulsed or a Most, depending on which state you're in, but it's not universal and they're not I think they are transferable and depending on the state. But still, it's not universal.
No, and they really are looking toward making it part of our electronic medical records, so that way when it goes
right
across state line.
Right, exactly. So I just have a couple questions here. One person asked us how you feel about the palliative care physician in the film not sitting down and standing to have the conversation with patient in the hospital bed. I believe he's referring or she's referring to
telemedicine
Norma,
and cybersecurity is presented by Dr. John
later.
White.
Do you want to address that?
Longitudinal care
not,
is presented by Dr. Robert
person,
Kane.
Standing.
Yeah, I did notice
yeah.
that because
I did too.
And I ran the fellowship at Rowan, and that's the first thing that I teach the fellows mm-hmm. or the nurses or the social workers that I work with is that get eye level and sit
right.
down on the thing. So that was very interesting that, somebody picked up on that.
Yeah, because so. Jeff's oncologist sat down in the chair next
risk
to him.
Risk stratification
right.
for endoscopy, is it necessary?
It's
presented by Dr. Kathleen
you
Drinan.
You sit down and take a breath with the patient, like, even though you're not spending that much more time, the perception of the patient mm-hmm. and the family is that you spent this enormous amount of time
right,
with
you were
them.
Present with them.
Right.
Not being hurried
so.
Or rushed. The second question that we have is how much intervention is possible in a hospice patient? Palliative chemo, paracentesis, et cetera. I know we've done that in the past as long as it's covered for palliation.
Right. So that varies hospice to hospice because under the hospice benefit, it's a per diem rate that mm-hmm. the hospice gets paid. So if they use, $10 worth of care or $2,500 worth of care a day, the hospice is going to get paid the same rate. So we do palliative thoracentesis, palliative paracentesis, those types of things. Chemotherapy, radiation are getting more and more difficult because a lot of the hospices are nonprofit and they would go bankrupt.
Right, right. It's too expensive.
So it is, 10 years ago, we did more radiation and palliative chemotherapy, but as things tighten up on the government side and the reimbursement side, I know more
the
and more
ACOI practice management breakout session, how to supplement
come,
your clinical income with lucrative
in
home-based work is presented by
months.
Mr. Stephen Babitsky with
it's
Seek
just
Incorporated.
Not feasible.
But CMS does have a model that
just in case
they're piloting
one.
Across the country. It's called MCCM. It's Medicare Choice Care Model. And under that, program, you can be receiving curative treatment
Correct.
While receiving hospice care.
So we were one of the first cohorts in the country, and we just presented at CMS actually 2 weeks ago. Our hospice and a hospice from Delaware were selected to present to the next cohort. And that is, like I said, like Megan was saying, it's Medicare Choices, Medicare Care Choices model. And they're going to be they're going to be rolling it out across the country that you can continue with curative treatments, aggressive interventions, and still get the hospice benefit. So they are making an attempt to recognize that people aren't willing to make that complete break.
Right. Right. And there's a lot of, you know, the support system in the home reduces all the hospitalizations. It reduces all the spending at the end of life. And if they have, obviously, that's their incentive to start this MCCM program to reduce Medicare spending. So I have another question for you from Grace. She says, what are your thoughts on the newer move for programs to start teaching about end of life and doing better about talking about it? I found that it helps, but really has influenced those who are more open to the idea rather than students and residents. Also, what are your thoughts about inappropriate recommendation of hospice by certain types of physicians for patients with treated illness, but difficult to manage dementia patients who are not end stage? I mean, dementia is a very highly, I mean, the eligibility is so strict
right.
with
and,
dementia.
Well, first, let's address the first part.
Right.
So I was very, actually, I just researched the internal medicine boards, and I was very interested to see that a lot of the questions would center, some of the questions, I won't say a lot, but palliative and hospice was infused throughout the exam. This time. And 10 years ago, that was palliative.
The ACOI ACOS keynote presentation, My Life Was Saved by Osteopathic Care, is presented by Mr. Vance Johnson.
The ACOI through the AOA to educate the next generation coming up to be much more comfortable with these conversations early on. It's a big lift because it's a big shift in our thinking. Because, like I said, we are always trained, the patient has A, we're supposed to do B, and, you know, like kind of step out of the room when, but, you know, when things are not going well. But I think the more people that get trained early and become comfortable and understand if you're not comfortable with these conversations, who of your colleagues are comfortable. Mm-hmm. Because it's okay. Like, we all learn certain things in medical school. We would never attempt them, like now, if it's not part of our practice. But if you're not comfortable with these conversations and you're not good at them, there is somebody on the healthcare team now that does have this skill.
Right, and going back to the osteopathic philosophy, you know, it's not just about the disease, right? It's the person.
Well,
it's the person as a whole.
And, you know, I always say dying is a team sport. Like,
right.
That you need to identify who in your nucleus, who in that patient's nucleus is really best to take over those communications.
And
right.
I just kind of want to add something because 10 years ago, we weren't hearing so much about the Conversation Project or death cafes. You know, people are getting more comfortable talking about what they want at the end of life. And so at the hospital, I would say that sometimes it's having the conversation is consumer-driven. When you have a family that's demanding hospice and a doctor that
acute
is
heart failure,
like
diuretics to LVAD, and everything in between
in
is presented by Dr.
You know,
George Sokos.
Who's requesting hospice. I see
the role of extracorporeal
well.
Membrane oxygenation
so
is presented by Dr. L.
Happen.
Keith Scott.
Absolutely. I just had a patient, I referred a patient on Thursday, and I asked him if his mother's doctor. The son, I asked
immune
his son
system
if his mother's doctor knew that
a
he
review
was requesting
of biologicals
hospice services.
Is presented
and they
by
had spoken
Dr.
to this
Robert
doctor
Hostoffer.
Like three times this week. And he said no.
Hereditary angioedema is presented by Dr. Brian Peppers.
But I said he's going to be blindsided that, you know, you're talking about a blood transfusion next week, and now he's going to get a call from us asking for a referral. So it is very much consumer-driven.
Metabolic bone disease therapeutic measures is presented by Dr. James Fitzpatrick.
Baby boomer generation ages. There's 11,000 people a day being enrolled on Medicare, and that baby boomer generation saw their parents go through end of life, and they probably won't be doing the same or following the same path So I have one more question going with Grace. She's referring to an article called How Doctors Die. I don't know if read that. Okay, I have too, which points out that often as providers we choose differently than what we advocate for our
patients. ACOI, ACOS keynote presentation, The Journey of Exploration, Where Medicine Meets Mars, is presented by Dr. J.B. Polk.
How many of you want to die in your own home? Have you thought about this? I'm sure you have, right? So I would say at least half, if not more. Just like the national average, 80% of Americans prefer to die at home, but only 20% do. It's very interesting with this audience in the room, what their preferences are. So, Marianne, did you want to talk about how providers choose differently?
Yeah. So the article that is being referenced was, I guess, about 2 years ago, and then it was picked up by the New York Times and the Huffington Post and kind of everybody. And it says, like, when the doctors will admit that, like, if you have, you know, you're diagnosed late stage 4 pancreatic cancer, what are you going to choose? Are you going to sit down and tell the surgeon, oh, yeah, do this again? You know, do the Whipple and do the experimental chemotherapy? Are you going to say, I want my pain meds and I'm going to go enjoy the time that I have left? And this physician, you know, kind of went through all the studies and stuff, and that they found that physicians were willing to make all these recommendations to patients and families, but when it came to their own families and their own choices, they wouldn't go down that path. Mm-hmm. So it's just very interesting. We're comfortable with our own mortality and our own knowledge about mortality, but we're not comfortable communicating it
right
with the people. But I think it goes back to, when patients come in and, you know, you ask them, so what's going on, blah, 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 you know, all those things. And then they say, oh, well, we have hope. And I say, well, hope isn't a two-sided coin. It's not a case that you have hope, she's going to live.
The ACOI REMS session is presented by Dr. Annette Karen.
You have to expand the definition of what you're hoping for when illness gets so advanced, and helping families identify what they're hoping for. Our patients.
I'm going to go back and do some extra stuff. We got a lot going on in this meeting, so I want to make sure
that she's not in pain, rather than that strict binary definition that we all go by.
Okay.
We have hope she lives. We don't have hope she dies.
Right, exactly. It's dynamic. It changes
Thursday sunrise
as you go
sessions.
Through the process. So let's go into, you know, specifically, what is palliative care?
Try it again. Thursday sunrise
sessions.
What's
palliative medicine? And then we'll go into
public health emergencies.
Hospice.
Use of real-time
Dr.
mobile
Holler,
communications
through,
is presented by Dr. Alfred Sorbello.
So it's very interesting because there's
hospitalist nephrology
say, I do my own
is presented
palliative
by
care.
Dr. John Pryor.
So strictly speaking, palliative medicine
handling
is
OIG
and
insurance
MD
company
consult.
Billing investigations is presented by Sheila Mintz.
Clinic inpatient consult service. Palliative care is the team approach to end-of-life care or care of the patient with advanced illness.
Friday.
So that's nursing,
sunrise sessions.
Spiritual, physical.
Pet-related
kind of
infections is presented by Dr. Lori Welton.
Identifying
estate planning is presented by Dr. Alexander.
Is.
No.
So we as
estate planning
tend
is presented
to
by Dr.
in a physical way. But is there
estate planning is presented by Alexander McNabb.
What burdens are causing
anticoagulation in the hospital is presented by Dr. Mary Jo Volpel.
Is through the team approach, because people have all kind of, unless you can explore that with patients and families, you don't know what the root of the actual suffering is.
Right.
Okay, so this is going to be Saturday
Casey, do you have,
sunrise
you don't have
sessions.
Palliative care at Claremont,
Sepsis
do you?
In the
do you,
hospital have, is presented Sillet? By Dr. Mia Taramina.
Okay, so
Washington
when he,
Update
when he
is presented by Mr. Timothy McNichol.
Consult, how does he bridge that gap with you when the person is really eligible for hospice?
Typically, okay, what happens else? Is he and a social worker will have the goals of care conversation, which makes
throw
my
this
job
this is
a lot easier when I walk in to speak
this
with
is
the
Saturday?
Family because they've already pretty
Saturday
much decided.
Special breakout session for state licensure requirements.
If there isn't
managing
a
the opioid epidemic is presented by
in,
Dr.
Then,
Robert Good.
These. I'm expected to have the goals of
the
care
ethics.
Conversation with the family, so that goes a little differently.
Ethics is presented
you know,
by Drs. Mitchell Foreman and Wendell Havens. No.
They do not want
ethics is presented by Drs. Mitchell Foreman
and
Weldon Havens. They
don't want her
Havens.
Coming back and forth to the hospital. And they
quality
want
and safety is presented
home.
By Dr.
Then,
David Condolucci.
You know, we start the process
AIDS,
of discharge
HIV
planning.
Is presented by
and
Dr. Mark Alandry.
Figure out do they need a hospital bed.
Human
oxygen,
trafficking is presented by Dr. Haney Stokolska.
From the acute care setting to the community. We would be responsible for ordering a comfort kit.
Human trafficking is presented by Dr. Haney Stuklosa.
Morphine, Ativan, Tylenol.
Intimate partner
violence.
Intimate partner violence is presented by Dr. Michelle Mendez.
That the patient may need in the middle of the night. And we also order oxygen to be delivered in the home on every single one of our patients, whether they need it right now, because as time progresses mm-hmm. and their disease progresses, we find that oftentimes the patients do become a little short of breath toward the end, and this is a comfort measure.
So, Tacy, do you want to just go into the, you know, what hospice is? In the, I don't know if you want to go into levels of care, you know, because you're in the hospital setting, it's inpatient level, but, you know, in the home, in routine.
Right. So there are four levels of hospice care that Medicare defines. One is routine, which is the most common type, which is done at home. However, you could also do routine hospice at a skilled nursing facility and assisted living. And with routine care, you receive the interdisciplinary approach of you have your hospice medical director, a nurse, social worker, pastoral care, and home health aid services. But a lot of people think that the home health aid services is 24 hours a day, but it isn't. It's whatever time it takes to give that person personal care is what Medicare defines mm-hmm. for a home health aide. There's respite care that, for instance, a family takes a patient home and the family starts getting burnt out from taking care of that patient. We can place that patient in a 24-hour skilled nursing facility for 5 days so that that family could get a break. And then there's general inpatient, which is really reserved for what we call ICU hospice, where there's unmanageable symptoms, which we aggressively treat in the hospital. And the hospice team co-manages with the primary care physician, whether it is starting them on a continuous morphine drip, you know, whatever it takes to get that person comfortable. And lastly, there's continuous care, which they call crisis care, at home. The patient is on home hospice and they develop a symptom that they are not able to manage appropriately. They'll put 24-hour care in there with a nurse and try to get that symptom under control.
Thank you, Tacy. We have a text question about what the status of payment for palliative care is. We have some eye rolls.
Okay, so in the hospital, it's a general physician nurse practitioner consult, so it goes under general medicine consults, 99223. In the home, now we have a visiting physician program. We have 3,200 patients at home, and they do primary palliative care in the home. Those patients have a length of stay of about 18 months, and then they transition to hospice. But they have to give up their primary care physician for us to get reimbursed that way. Mm-hmm. So under Medicare, you can have, Annette, help me out, the end-of-life discussion. I'm trying to think.
Oh, yeah, there's a reimbursement.
There's
for
a reimbursement.
A consultation of end-of-life.
Right.
Advanced care planning.
Right, advanced care planning.
Two different brackets of time allotted.
And then, right, so it's like 30, you could have a 30-minute conversation.
Right.
I think Medicare is billing. I'm trying to find the code for you. 99497 to have goals of care conversation in your offices, and then for each additional 30 minutes that you spend, it's 99498.
The Conversation Project has an actual flyer on all of the reimbursement codes and what the procedure is for advanced care planning consultations.
But palliative care in and of itself does have reimbursement problems, because if you are not sponsored by your healthcare system or an agency and you're trying to do this as a private doc, you're going to starve. Because if you figure, you know, my consults are 90 minutes, sometimes 2 hours minimum. So if you're seeing 6 patients a day, you can, you know, add it up, like, because you're still billing at your regular 99223, like your regular initial consults. So
in the hospital setting.
In the hospital setting. So the practices that do palliative care and are financially successful, there has to be some buy-in from the agencies and the healthcare systems where you practice.
Mm-hmm. One more question. How do you speak with a young paraplegic patient who has refused total care in skilled nursing facilities and has revolving hospitalizations for sepsis due to infected decubiti, UTIs, hospice stop following patient, and would not speak to them? Why would they? Yeah, I'm not sure why. It depends on the hospital. If you're in a skilled nursing facility receiving hospice care and you're transferred to a hospital and you're not, the hospital doesn't have an affiliation with that skilled nursing, the patient has to come off hospice while they're being hospitalized. But then when they're discharged again, they could be readmitted. So I'm not really sure why this hospice would not, they can't follow the patient per se in the hospital actively, but they can readmit.
But if the patient has then refused acute treatment, like I actually had this patient in the past that, and the local hospice, very interesting, because the local hospice was like, oh, there's no hospice diagnosis. But we had 11 hospitalizations for, you know, continued infections. And then the cultures were multi-drug resistant. So we were at the point where the antibiotics weren't going to do anything anyway. But I actually had to have a conversation with the hospice, because the hospice was like, well, there's not a real hospice diagnosis. And they had turned the patient down initially, and then the family doctor sent them back to the hospital one more time, and they were like, Dr. Holler, we'll figure this out for you. But it was a shame that the patient had to go through another hospitalization to get on hospice, and he died like 3 weeks later on hospice at home.
That's a long time on hospice, 3 weeks, actually.
We are trying to move the length of stay a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. So going, you know, back to what hospice is, I just want to cover, you know, how it's reimbursed. I think Marianne, you covered, or Tacy said it was a per diem rate. It's a per diem rate that's paid to the hospice agency regardless of what expenses are incurred to care for that patient. So when you do have a short length of stay, you're expending so many resources, because it's really like a crisis intervention. You know, if the person is, you know, living their last 5 days of life, there's a ton of education and teaching and resources that go into caring for a person with that short length of stay. But Medicare is by vastly the largest payer source for hospice services, which became a benefit 35 years ago, but also private insurers as well. So Marianne already mentioned that obviously hospice is not just for cancer, even though being mortal did follow only cancer patients. And then going back to hope, we do have a question about hope. How do you put realism into hope? And I think you can answer that, Marianne, about, you know, addressing short-term and long-term goals.
Right, because there's certain things that come up continuously in end-of-life discussions, and one of them is the hope question. And the other thing is religion. Like, we believe, like, God is going to... there's going to be a miracle. So I have two comments to the people that I work with and the people that, the nurses, interns, residents, medical students. One, those conversations are not barriers to appropriate end-of-life care. They're opportunities. So in terms of the hope question, I will confront it head-on. When they say, oh, we have hope, and when we say, well, you know, let's, it doesn't help you or your family member, or if it's the patient, doesn't help you if I don't tell you the truth. Mm-hmm. And I confront it head on in a family meeting or a meeting with the patient. And people are generally appreciative and responsive when you say exactly those things. It doesn't help you or me or your family member if I don't tell you the truth. And I would love to tell you that, you know, like, everything's gonna go, you know, because people say, oh, we don't want any negative, we don't want to talk negative. And but saying to them honestly, like, everything doesn't always go how we hope, and trying to help them expand their definition of what they're hoping for. And I say exactly those words, like, hope isn't a two-sided coin. Mm-hmm. We have to think more broadly because of this illness. We have to think about what we're hoping for. Like, we hope that she lives as long as she can, or that you live as long as you can. I want that for you too. But if, you know, you've been declining over the past few weeks, months, whatever, what types of things are important, and what are you hoping for other than a longer life?
Right, right. Nora's hope was to take her presumably a grandbaby to Disney World, which was, you know, in the winter, presumably, again, months away. So how could, you know, how could hospice have, or that hospital, kind of, you know, change that hope? I mean, we have a final wishes program, and we would have brought Disney to
right.
her.
Right, and when, like, hope and goals are kind of the same conversation, mm-hmm. so I say, you know, what types of things are you hoping for? Like, what's your goal? And then, you know, some of you have heard before, like, I always say, you know, like, oh, I want to see my daughter graduate from college. If your next question better be, how old is she? Because if they tell you she's 7, that's a different conversation than if you they tell you, oh, it's 6 months from now, or she's going to graduate in December. So you can't be afraid of where these conversations go, and
right.
to take them where they where they're going to lead.
And the silence, you know, the silence is very important.
Right. So, and the other question that comes up all the time is, well, you know, we have faith and God's going to heal them. And a lot of people see that. I have a friend that's a critical care doctor, and he says, as soon as the Bible comes out and they mention Jesus, I know I need to fold up my tent and walk out of the room. But that is an opportunity. They're acknowledging exactly what you're telling them. If they're telling you, oh, we know there's going to be a miracle and God's going to heal them, they've just admitted that we're in a place that man can't help her. So it's not a barrier. It's an opportunity to expand the conversation even further. And I'll say, in those situations, I say, I'm so glad you're a family of faith. Because people that don't have faith don't understand that life has a beginning and an end. So it's another opportunity to get deeper into that conversation. But like I said, empowering yourself to develop those skills and tools about, what do I say when somebody says God's going to heal them? What do I say when they say, you know, like, we have hope? And just like how to guide the next level of that conversation.
Right. And Tasik, how do you deal with families who, you know, don't want to inform the person who's being cared for, the patient? You know, how do you handle situations where either they want to have a conversation in front of the person while they're, like, asleep in the room, or they want to hide it from their loved one? How do you handle families that, you know, try to avoid it, or they don't want the word hospice used?
It's different, I think, for every family, mm-hmm. right? Because if you want to be culturally competent, there are certain cultures where they do not want that loved one to know. And you kind of have to tippy-toe around that a little bit. Where we haven't used the word hospice in the home. They said, don't use the word hospice
right,
in the home.
Right.
So we'll say, okay, we'll call it palliative care, you know.
So
again, you just have to be very careful and sensitive around, you know, where is that coming from? Is the family in denial, or is it really a cultural thing? Maybe you want to add a little bit.
Right, and that prompts me to ask the question, what concerns you about your mom knowing what's going on? Because 9 times out of 10, the patient knows what's going
right,
on. Unless it's end-stage dementia, the patient's not talking to the family, and the family's not talking to the patient.
Right, they're protecting so each other.
I'll say, what concerns you about your mom or your dad or your sister or your husband knowing the truth? And how would you feel if it was you in the bed? Would you want to know the truth, or would you want this conversation taking place in a different room? So, again, you know, hitting it head on has been my approach as a palliative care doctor. Not, okay, you don't want your mom to know. I had a family once tell me, don't tell my dad he needs his leg taken off. I'm like, well, how are you going to explain it post-op?
He's going to wake up one day with no leg.
Like, what are you going to do? Never take the sheet down? Like, we're not going to go down that path. Like, we can't tell my dad that he's going to take his leg off because... I'm like, that's not going to happen. Like, that kind of medicine ended in 1962.
Right,
like, we
right.
don't practice that way anymore.
We have another question, which is, how do you address fears of death? And I think that's a great question, because I think even the gentleman with brain cancer, he admitted he wasn't afraid of dying. He was afraid of suffering. And
how do you address fear of what?
Fear of death. So the right to die movement, all of these, you know, I think are almost, I don't want to say fear based, but people do really fear suffering at the end of life.
Right. And I, again, when I'm talking to a patient, when I do a symptom review, I say, are you anxious? Like, do you have anxiety about what's going on? And it's funny, sometimes patients say, you know, no one asked me that. Like, they know they're dying. They know they have a limited amount of time. And knowing who on the team can best meet that, what we were talking about before, suffering is not a physical entity. Who on the team can best help identify that spiritual, that emotional, that all those non-physical suffering that come into the dying process.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to take it all on yourselves as primary care physicians or subspecialties. Is, you know, spread out the pain a little bit amongst
your colleagues.
Which
is why hospice is interdisciplinary.
Right. So, yeah. So fear of dying is very real. And there's medications, obviously, you can give somebody for anxiety, but to get down to, you know, what can we help you accomplish in the time that, whatever time you have left.
Yeah. And we also, I want to just tell you, when we talk about hope and how it's dynamic, I just want to share 2 quick stories with you. We only have about 7 minutes left, but I want to share this story with you from one of our hospice patients. We have a final wishes program, which helps, you know, people achieve what they hope for, whatever that hope is. It could be, you know, celebrating their birthday. It can be going to the zoo with the family. It could be taking their grandson to, like, you know, the grandfather's or patient's favorite fishing lake. But this person, Helene, she wanted to take a tour of her church. She is on our program. She's in a skilled nursing facility. And her church had just done a renovation. So it was very important to her to go see this St. Philomena's church, which was actually just down the street, but she did need an ambulance, you know, to take her. We pushed her around in the wheelchair, and she gave the whole team, you know, whoever was there, this whole education about St. Philomena and what this saint did and why she was canonized. And I called over to the Monsignor, who was actually at the rectory at the time, and he came over to meet with us. And she went over this whole funeral mass plan with him because she had done her own, you know, her own funeral already. And she says to him, I want you to know, Monsignor, that I hired a priest from Seton Hall University to do my mass. I hope you're not offended. I mean, you can still be here, but the priest from Seton Hall is doing my mass. And then the music director just happened to be there, so he, you know, listened to her requests about, you know, what songs she wanted at her funeral. And then we took her to lunch. And, you know, we're a nonprofit organization, and I do all the fundraising. And I started this program last year because we do have requests from patients who, you know, who get it. They want to live, you know, their best days possible in the end. They want to have a quality of life. They want to be the Jeffs, you know, who are passing away at home and having these conversations with grandchildren. So she made a donation to us, which is actually going to fund our annual volunteer appreciation dinner next year that will be held in her memory. You know, we will be sure to tell her story, to share these pictures at this volunteer appreciation dinner, because she was a former hospice volunteer, and this is very important to her. So, you know, when you talk about the fear of death, you know, you also, everyone, no matter who you are, you have to find meaning in your life. You have to, you know, leave knowing that your life mattered, and this is one way that we help this patient find that meaning. Last week, we had a patient on our program who is 30 years old. She has a daughter who is going to be 2 years old on December 20th, and her primary caretaker is her mother, who's also a nurse, and they wanted to know if we could have a Christmas party for them. So we put together this whole Christmas party for her. This was last Friday. I had a person dress up as Santa Claus. We brought him on a fire truck, which the township, you know, wholeheartedly accommodated for us. And we had presents wrapped for all the children that were there. We had a videographer come and stay for like 3 hours during this Christmas party and film these little vignettes of over 50 people who attended this party about how meaningful and this person is to them, this 30-year-old woman. And, you know, that film is going to be given to this 2-year-old daughter. So she'll know her mother, and she'll know, you know, her friends and families who loved her. And, of course, you know, we had it catered and we brought food so the family wouldn't have to do anything extra. Even our volunteers went over to the house and decorated it beforehand. So everything was ready. I had a donor buy gifts for everybody. We had everything wrapped in different wrapping paper per person. But there's an incredible opportunity to give people meaning at the end of life. And, you know, it's important to be honest with people who are facing end-stage diseases, because if you know your date of death, which none of us do, but if you were given your date of death when you were born, you would all live differently. You know, you would all make different decisions, and you would all, you know, probably say, if this is my last 4 weeks on, you know, on Earth, I want to do something different. So if anybody has any other questions, you can text them to us, but I want to thank the panel. I want to thank the ACOI for hosting us. Again, I'm sorry about the technical difficulties. You never know with technology if it's going to work or not, but the team pulled it off for us. And that's it. So thank you.